pulmonary embolism and fainting,
a new treatment for osteoporosis,
hernia repair,
and using genetic analysis to guide breast cancer therapy.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on October 21st, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think I'm going to go right to the Journal of the American Medical Association this week. Hernias, of course, a really big problem. I thought we had it all sewn up, and I don't mean that as a pun, with the use of mesh to put those hernias back in place. But gosh, now we're looking at something a little different.
Specifically, the hernias that we're talking about with regard to this study are those that occur in the abdominal wall. And a hernia being just a defect in the muscular layer. So in this particular instance, hernia repairs in the United States are pretty common, with about 350,000 done each year. There are two general ways of doing it. One is putting in a mesh, a biocompatible material. The other is just to close it with sutures. And the mesh has kind of been the standard of care over the last several years, although we don't really have a lot of studies looking at the long-term outcomes associated with it. So that was the purpose for this particular study. And to do that, they looked at over 3,200 patients who underwent hernia repair either using a mesh, either standard surgery or laparoscopically implanted, or just routine surgery. And they followed these patients for a course of about 5 years. And here's what they found out. The chance of the hernia recurring was lower if mesh was used. It was about 12% in the patients who received mesh, about 17% that had the open surgery. That was over 5 years. Now, by the way, part of this is explained because the mesh was used in smaller size hernias, where open surgery was used in the larger ones. But here's the trade-off. On down the road, there were many more major complications with mesh than with open surgery. Things like bowel perforation, or the development of a connection between the abdomen and the outside called a fistula, or chronic infections or late abscesses in the abdomen or non-healing wounds, even bowel obstruction. So these occurred about 5 to 6% more commonly in patients that had mesh than those that had open surgery.
And as we talked about, since this is such a very common operation, it sounds to me like the use of mesh really needs to be examined more closely.
I think so, Elizabeth. And I think armed with this information, the physician can present to the patient which is most concerning to you, a recurrence rate that's about 5% higher with standard surgery, or the risk of a major serious complication that's 5% higher with mesh. And so the patient can be involved in this decision-making process.
But a big problem, I think. Let's go from here to the New England Journal of Medicine. Something that is also a big problem, that's osteoporosis, and here's a new agent for its potential management.
We've talked over the course of the last decade about several different types of therapy and the rationale. And there's been a lot of different research into different types of agents or different pathways responsible for osteoporosis, because it's really a balance between the formation of new bone and the resorption of existing bone. We've not had a lot of new therapies that have been involved with the formation of new bone. There's been a new protein discovered called sclerostin. What was noted is that people that were deficient in this had high bone mass and they were resistant to fractures. Consequently, pharmaceutical companies have now made an antibody to this particular protein. And this protein, by the way, prevents bone formation. So if you inhibit it, you allow new bone formation. So what the investigators did in this study is they identified almost 7,200 postmenopausal women who were at risk of fracture, that is, they had osteoporosis. And they randomized them to receive this antibody called romosuzumab to sclerostin or placebo. And then after 12 months, they put them on an agent that prevented bone resorption. Both groups got that after 12 months. So they followed these individuals for 12 months and 24 months. And what they discovered is that the individuals who received this new agent that increased bone formation, in the first year, they had a 73% lower risk of having a new vertebral fracture. When they followed them for 24 months, that risk reduction continued. This is great news because it shows that we can provide one therapy that increases bone formation and then switch to an existing therapy that prevents bone resorption with very good results.
I think that this is an injection, isn't it?
It is. This is an injection that's delivered once a month underneath the skin called subcutaneously.
So that's not too onerous, I guess, for women to come in, especially if they can avoid a vertebral fracture.
Absolutely. And by the way, the existing agent that all these patients went on after 12 months is also an injectable form. In fact, when our listeners hear any type of a therapy that ends in mab, like romosuzumab, it usually means an antibody, and that requires an injection that can't be delivered orally.
Okay, so we'll keep our eyes on this as it gets expanded into greater use and see if we see anything over the long haul that causes us to pause. Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, then let's turn to something else I found rather surprising, a relationship between pulmonary embolism and syncope or fainting.
Elizabeth, it's been known for a long time that when people develop a large blood clot to the lungs, also called a pulmonary embolism, these individuals can experience syncope or fainting. They faint and then they resuscitate in usually less than a minute. What this is thought to be due to is sudden obstruction of blood flow to the lungs, but there may be some other mechanisms. Well, when people come in to the hospital or the emergency room with syncope and are admitted, there are a number of different things that can cause syncope. How often is it due to a pulmonary embolism? These investigators looked at 560 patients. They all presented to the emergency department. They were all admitted for further evaluation. They were randomized either having low risk for pulmonary embolism, that is, they didn't have any of the routine physical exam findings, and they had a negative D-dimer test. That's a blood test that goes along with pulmonary embolism. So if they had none of those, they got no further evaluation for pulmonary embolism. But if either of these or both of these were positive, then they went to further evaluation. And that was about 40% of the patients. And among those 40%, pulmonary embolism was also identified in about 40%. Overall, that means the prevalence was about 1 in 6 patients that were hospitalized for a first episode of syncope ended up with a pulmonary embolism as a diagnosis.
Right. And I thought, my gosh, this is really a high number. I was surprised by it.
Yep. In fact, it was about 13% of individuals that had an alternative explanation for their syncope and about 25% who did not that ended up with this diagnosis. And the reason why it's important to make this diagnosis is because you treat this with blood thinners. If pulmonary embolism is large and is not treated, then it oftentimes can result in death. I think this is a really important study. I'm glad you picked it.
Certainly something that we need to be on the lookout for somebody who comes into the ED with a first episode of fainting.
And again, that they have either a positive blood test or they're intermediate or high risk by what are called the Wells criteria. Those individuals should undergo an evaluation.
Finally, then, we're going to turn to the journal Cancer. And this is the one that you found most interesting, so I'm going to let you serve it up.
Elizabeth, it looked at the decision of what kind of chemotherapy to use for women that have breast cancer and how the patients feel about it. Typically in the past, the indication for using chemotherapy, that is after surgical resection of the cancer, was dependent upon what the hormonal status of the tumor was and whether there were lymph nodes involved. However, we now have a genetic test called a 21 gene recurrence score assay. It's a test that in individuals that are considered to be low or intermediate risk for recurrence can further give us information. So lower intermediate risk based upon the hormonal status and the positive or negative nodes. Well, in this particular study, the investigators looked at how often physicians turned to using this genetic test and whether it altered therapy. And importantly, were the women satisfied with the use of this test? And what they discovered was in women that were lower intermediate risk by routine measures that had this genetic testing done, if it also suggested low risk, the physicians usually recommended no chemotherapy, and most often women complied with that. Conversely, if the genetic test suggested that the risk was high, most women were recommended to have chemotherapy, and most did. And consequently, the patients were very satisfied with having this additional information. So it was most useful in preventing chemotherapy that wouldn't be useful, and the women were satisfied about that. This is a great example of how this genetic testing can be rolled into a routine practice in this particular study of over 4,000 women.
Clearly, it's great to avoid chemotherapy if you don't need it. Wasn't there something in this study about women often wanted to have this genetic assessment, whether they needed it or not?
You're right, Elizabeth, and that goes to the high-risk group. That was, if you already are known to be at a high risk of recurrence, many of those women, and even some of the doctors, still wanted to do the genetic testing. And in that particular instance, I'm not sure it adds any value at all, because we're still going to recommend they undergo chemotherapy in most circumstances. One of the interesting things about this test is they looked to see whether there are any racial or ethnic differences in how it was used, because there is some data that suggests that different ethnicities receive different types of therapy. But in this particular case, there was no difference in testing or treatment with regard to the patient's race or ethnicity, which goes to leveling the playing field.
And also is really good news, I think.
Yep. I think this is a great example of how we're using newer diagnostic treatments to receive that precision medicine we're talking about.
Indeed. On that note then, that's the one I'll talk about in the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.